Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Good evening. Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite all our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. Now, this is a no-holds-barred show, and I'm not going to pull any punches. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep that open mind. This way, you can come to see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my special guest is John G., and I'm not providing his last name because he's an addict in recovery who's going to share some of his powerful recovery experience, and it's the tradition of 12-step programs to remain anonymous. So I hope you'll realize that he's courageous just talking, stepping forward to tell his story, but it is a tradition within 12-step programs not to provide last names. Just to let you know a little bit about what's been going on for me, I told you last week I was working on Book 13 in the Sister Mary Olga Fortitude series. Well, I finished it yesterday, and this morning I started Book 14, and I've written 10 pages already today, so I'm off to the races with that. But if anybody wants to find those books for Christmas presents, the titles are The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude and Babes and Buck Snort, and again, they're written under the pen name of Davis Ojerdwe, which you don't need to know. Just go to Amazon, put in The Misadventures of Sister Mary Olga Fortitude or Babes and Buck Snort, and if you get them both, you'll have free shipping and handling. So enough on that. Let's get down to the show. Let me tell you a little bit about John. John's an interior designer that specializes in kitchen and bath design. For over 20 years, he's been creating innovative solutions for his clientele throughout upstate New York as well as on a national scale. His designs have been featured in numerous magazines such as Women's Day, House Beautiful, Kitchen and Bath, Remodeling Magazine, Qualified Remodeler, and many other local and regional publications. His designs have received both national and regional awards. As an active member of the National Kitchen Bath Association, that's NKBA, John has served on the board of directors at both the local and regional level for more than a decade. In addition to practicing interior full-time, John is an adjunct faculty member of interior design at a local community college. He enjoys shaping the next generation of design professionals with his expertise. In 2012, he received the President's Award for Excellence in Teaching. In 2005 and 2006, John's projects were selected as the cornerstone of the National Kitchen and Bath Association's advertising campaign. In 2012, the NKBA named him as one of the most inspirational kitchen and bath designers in the United States. And his mantra is this: truly exceptional designs are always a collaborated effort. So, I'd like to welcome you, John. How are you tonight?
I'm well, David. Thank you.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. I appreciate you coming on the show. As I mentioned, I think it takes a lot of courage for somebody to come forward and be willing to talk about something that, at least for me, since I'm also a recovering sex addict, has caused me much shame in my past. And even in recovery, it's caused me shame because it hasn't been perfect. I've had some relapses along the way. But I've always admired your recovery, and John is in my own 12-step program. We won't mention the name of the program, but it is a 12-step program for recovery. And later in the program, I will mention the different 12-step programs that are available for somebody that might want to recover from sexual addiction. So, John, I'm wondering, can you tell me a little bit about your growing up years and your family of origin?
Well, absolutely. I'm the youngest of growing up in an Italian family. I'm the youngest boy. I'm the only boy in my immediate family. I have two older siblings, and my sisters are 7 and 9 years older than myself. So growing up, my father wasn't around very much. He was he had a job that took him, and he traveled quite a bit, and he was maybe home maybe 3 days a week on a regular basis. He would be gone from, you know, Sunday or Monday through Thursday. And during that period of time while he was gone, it was relatively peaceful at home. But when he would come back home, it was very stressful. And it was almost like you were walking on pins and needles when he came in the door. And now that I have been in recovery for a period of time, I actually understand a little bit more about why he was the way he was. And I can share more about that as we get into this.
Okay, thank you, John. You talked about having to walk around on pins and needles, and I'm not sure exactly what that was about, but I'm wondering if you still need to find any healing from any of your family of origin issues.
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the areas of my recovery that I really need to focus on, and that is making an amends with my father. We were estranged for over 20 years during a period of time while my mother and he got divorced. He was away from us, all of us. And actually, 10 years ago was the first time we reconnected. And we reconnected when I was having surgery, and he came to see me in the hospital. And it was during that period of time that he came around a little bit more, but again, I was very cautious and had a lot of trepidation about getting close to him because I was afraid. You know, I was afraid of being hurt, I was afraid of rejection, and I was afraid of, you know, all the things that had been built up inside of me over the years growing up without a father. It was very difficult, you know. And a lot of my addiction stems from that, I think, you know, reaching out for other types of medication to be able to satiate my need for comfort.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What do you mean by medication?
Yeah, for me, I'm you know, when I say use the term medication, my sexual addiction is one of acting out behavior. When I say acting out, it's pay for sex. Prostitution, strip clubs, strip bars, massage parlors, things of that nature. And that started, when I was about 18. When I was 18 years old, I found that I could, I would get into clubs and I would start spending more time. I was fascinated with the whole idea of these women in these clubs and the idea that they would tell me how wonderful I was, you know, knowing well that I was paying for that, but it was still stimulating and it was still very exciting. And it really gave me that dopamine hit that I was looking for. And so the same thing happened for me with drugs. I'm cross addicted to marijuana. And I would tell you that, you know, they go hand in hand. If I decide that I'm going to, start smoking pot again, typically I want to act out. It's just kind of a ritual behavior that I have. And that's the big thing in my addiction is that it's very ritualistic. I have patterns and things that I have to do over and over the same way. You know, like when I was in the throes of my addiction and acting out, I was seeing in the upwards of, 4 prostitutes a week, maybe 5, and sometimes I would go to the strip club maybe 2 or 3 times. But part of my ritual behavior dealt with the online escort services and being involved in blogging the experience afterwards. That was all part of the ritual.
Okay. Well, you've brought up a couple of more questions for me. One is, if can you tell the audience what it was that you might have been medicating? Do you have any insight into that now?
Absolutely.
As far as go.
Yeah, I think I can. And you know, I was lonely, and my mother and father got divorced or separated when I was 12, and divorced when I was 14. So during those formidable years, my mom, I was a latchkey kid, and my mom was not around very much. So I was alone, and during that period of time, I turned to masturbation, turned to pornography, all sorts of pornography. And at first, to me, it was impulsive. You know, it was something I could do as a young boy, and it seemed acceptable, and it was normal because that's what young men did. And as I got a little bit older, the impulse was something I couldn't control, and it became a compulsion that I could not control. And I think that stems from my loneliness, you know, being at home alone, looking to comfort myself, looking to feel as though it was okay. You know, and my mother was out working, and she had her own issues as well, dealing with that divorce. So she really couldn't be there to help mold me during this period of time. So when I was alone, and I just remember it being, growing up in the region that we are, in upstate New York, it was such a – I remember the cold winters of being at home alone, and the only thing that would comfort me was my medication, my drug of choice. In this case, when I was a young boy, it was pornography.
Yeah. Well, I can relate on a couple of counts. One thing I can relate to is the cross addiction, because I'm also a recovering alcoholic and recovering drug addict, and I would often find myself going into one arena and then into the next. Likewise with cigarettes. I've given up cigarettes many times. When I would act out, I might bum a cigarette and become addicted to that again, or vice versa. So it is a challenging balancing act, if you will. And the other thing I could relate to was that loneliness, and it made me think of a wonderful book that's out about sexual addiction called Lonely All the Time. And I think that will resonate with anybody that has had the experience of sexual addiction. For me, other significant feelings would be anxiety was a big trigger, anger, sadness, which quite often was buried beneath anger, any uncomfortable feelings or feelings that had a negative charge to them would propel me into the arena of sexual addiction. And the other thing I wanted to back up on, John, was you talked about your father coming to see you when you had the surgery. I know you've had some serious medical issues. Is that anything you'd want to talk about?
Sure, yeah. I was diagnosed with an acoustic neuroma, and it's a benign brain tumor. And this was 10 years ago, and it was significant. The tumor was the size of a tennis ball, and when it was removed, my first surgery was something in the neighborhood of around 14 hours, and my second surgery that I had to have just a week later was maybe another 6 or 8 hours, and it was very traumatic. Just to overcome that was unbelievable, and I want to tell you that I wasn't acting out sexually, prostitutes before this happened. I mean, let me back up and say that's not entirely true. I was, but again, it was more infrequently. But after the brain surgery, my face was left, partially, I have facial weakness, so there's a little bit of paralysis on the left side of my face, and that really changed me. It really changed my whole outlook. I mean, my smile wasn't symmetrical anymore, and I used to have a beautiful smile, and I loved to smile, and I was happy, and, you know, now when I look in the mirror, I don't see that person anymore, you know, and so I was unhappy, and just like you were describing, David, those feelings of sadness, unhappy, those are the things that made me want to medicate, you know, and after the brain surgery episode, and after the paralysis and all the recovery and going through that, because, I mean, it took at least 6-7 months before I actually went back to work. And after that, when I went back to work, I wasn't the same. And it was probably about a year before I actually got back to a place where I was in a position where I was actually doing things, you know, kind of the way I was before. It takes that long to recover. And And as I was saying, you know, once looking back on that now in recovery, that had a huge part to play in my decisions to act out the way that I had been, you know, during that period of time. You know, because that propelled me into a pattern of sexual addiction that lasted at least 8-9 years.
Yeah. Well, let's back up quite a bit. I wanted to ask you during your childhood what your religious and spiritual life was like.
Well, I was, born into a Catholic, an Italian Catholic family, and my mother converted to, I guess she would, you know, you could say, a lot of people might say, you know, a charismatic faith. You could say born again. You could say Pentecostal. That's the faith that we converted into. And I was 7 years old at that time. And slowly but surely, one by one, all of my family members joined this church, and we had a strong bond, a very strong connection with the parishioners at this church and many of the friends that I still have today. Growing up with them, I still have very close relationships with. So we had a spiritual belief system. At that time, I kind of, looking back on it, I thought it was one of, kind of like if you behaved and you did the right things, God would reward you. But if you slipped up and you made a mistake, that you'd be punished. That punished and reward, you know, the reward and the punishment system, you know, very, very much was ingrained in me. And even though I knew that God was a loving God, I had a belief that my God was one who loved me. I didn't understand. It wasn't until many, many years later, I didn't understand that even if I did something wrong, he didn't stop loving me. I hate that word wrong. If I did something that I perceived as negative, he didn't stop loving me. It just, it puts a wedge between me and God, and I can't benefit from all the things he has to offer me, if that makes any sense.
It sure does, and I really like the way you reframed it from saying wrong to negative. I found that in my past I had very black and white thinking. I would think in terms of right and wrong, and now I think in terms of positive or negative, appropriate or inappropriate, because for me to label things as right and wrong is casting a judgment, and it can set me up. It's that perfectionistic thinking that actually drives the addict, and I need to stay away from that if I'm going to remain in a healthy place and not judge my fellow man or judge myself, because I need to be compassionate, not just towards other people, but especially toward myself, and I sure wasn't when I was in my addiction. I'm sure you can relate to that.
I couldn't agree more. Everything you just said is exactly 100% the way I feel.
Yeah. Let me pick up your addiction story from you were talking about around 18 when you started getting involved with the prostitution and strip clubs. Can you trace your addiction forward and tell me, I know you're a married man, tell me what happened once you got married, how the addiction may have started up again after that, and then talk a little bit about what recovery has been like for you.
I would say that just before I got married, I was very active with strip clubs, not as much with prostitutes, although I had seen a handful of prostitutes in my lifetime before I got married. I really actually spent more time in strip clubs. I actually used to work at a strip club. I found that very exhilarating because the idea, the notion that the people that were there, those beautiful people that everybody wanted to admire, were people that I could be with or out sexually with when I wanted to, was exhilarating, you know, and it really was electric. Again, I make that reference of a dopamine hit. It was the same kind of thing that I would get from that. And then as I began to get more serious with my my wife, before we got married, I began to refrain from that, knowing that she hated it, knowing that she wanted, no part of it. And I will say that I did sneak a few times, here and there. And that's a big part of my addiction is sneaking. That whole idea of, I wouldn't want to go to a strip bar with a bunch of guys. That wouldn't be enjoyable to me. It would be far more enjoyable for me to go to a strip bar alone because then I can get the attention that I'm looking for, and I can also get deeper into the fantasy, and that's a big part of it is the fantasy, the manipulation, the idea of spending that money and making myself feel good because they tell me, because when you spend, hundreds of dollars in a strip club, the people that you're paying are going to tell you how wonderful you are. So naturally, it's going to start to make you feel really good about yourself. That kind of behavior worked best for me when I was alone in isolation. I wouldn't want to go to a strip club with two or three other guys and drop $400. I mean, that would be like exposing way too much of my addiction to somebody, if that makes any sense.
It sure does.
Yeah. I'm sure you can relate to that. So
I can.
So
one of the big...
said that. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to reflect on one of the consequences, and we can get into this later, but it sounds like one of the big consequences for you were financial consequences connected to the addiction. You're talking about big bucks. If you're talking
absolutely. I mean, I was spending money that I didn't have. I was misappropriating money from government, from New York State, from the federal government. I was, misappropriating money from my clients, and ultimately I ended up losing my business.
Well, that's a big consequence, John. What was your bottom? I'm sure you
my
had
bottom,
more than one.
Yeah,
what brought you
bottom,
into
my bottom hit me right between the eyes. Probably about 3.5 years ago was when I really got into recovery. And it was during that period of time, it was the summer, and my wife had just come back from a trip with the kids, which I told her I would not be able to go on because I had too much work going on. But what that really meant was I was orchestrating my acting out, behavior, and I was, going to spend lots of time and lots of money with prostitutes. And when she came home, my son, at the time, he wanted my old cell phone, which actually had completely died about 6 months before. I mean, there was no charge to it. There was no way it was even functional. And when I brought the cell phone in to have it repaired, they couldn't get it to actually turn on. There was no power to the phone whatsoever. And so I said, well, what should I do? And they're like, well, there's nothing we can do. You have to buy a new phone. And so the phone sat in my drawer for a period of at least 6 months. And my son asked for this phone. After he came back from vacation, he wanted it. I wasn't home. And my wife said, it doesn't work. Here, I'll show you. She took the phone. She pushed the on button, and it fired up with all the power that you would need to be able to go in and see. Because the phone wasn't able to access the phone. I was unable to wipe it clean of all of my acting out, partners, the phone numbers, the contacts, the emails, the text messaging was what she saw. And then that was my bottom. I came home from work that day. She had dinner on the table. And she said to me, she looked me square in the eye. And she said, basically she gave me an ultimatum. And she said, you can come clean and tell me what's going on, And she started just asking me names of people that were in my phone, just reciting names and asking me who this one was and who that one was. And the barrage of questions didn't stop. And finally, she said, I want to know what's going on. Who are you? Who are these people? What's going on? I know you're cheating on me. And at this point in time, we had been married for about 13 years. And so I said to her, we have three young boys, and they were actually downstairs, and we talked, and as I sat there, I couldn't believe. I opened my mouth, and I told her what I'd been doing. I told her the whole thing. There was no lying anymore. I was at the point where, you know, I was trained to lie. I had trained myself to lie my entire life, but I couldn't do it anymore. I just could not bring myself to lie anymore about this because I was caught red-handed, and there was no more lying, and I just had a breakdown and started crying and weeping, and I just told her what happened, and that was my bottom. And after that, the very next day, I went into the program that you and I met in.
Well, John, that is, it's a wonderful thing that that happened for you. And I'm sure that at the time it didn't feel wonderful. But I think we need these bottoms to bring us into recovery. There's so many addicts that are in denial and that go through life without those kinds of painful consequences, or when faced with a consequence like that, will continue to lie. And I can so relate to the lying. I did that all my life. I always had a pack of lies lined up for whenever my partner might suspect something was going on. Whenever I was late, I'd have an excuse. Whenever I needed to go out and get a fix, if you will, I'd say I was going shopping or this, that, or the other thing. And I had a similar bottom in my former relationship, which was a 24-year relationship, where what had happened to me is I'd stopped being sexual with my partner for 10 years, and I'd also developed impotence, which was psychological, as far as I can tell, I don't need to get into the whys and wherefores, except that there was so much guilt that was going on for me when I was cheating on this man who thought I wasn't having sex anymore. We weren't having sex, and I needed Viagra in order to be able to get an erection. So one day he was recycling trash, and he found this toilet paper roll that had the ends turned in, and he opened it up to put it in the recycling bin, and in it was an empty vial of Viagra. And he confronted me, and that was my bottom. That's what brought me back into the program. I'd been in it previously many, many years ago, and I'm so grateful for that. He gave me the ultimatum, either you go to couples counseling with me or it's over. When I got to couples counseling, I knew I'd have to deal with this demon. And I use that word figuratively because I don't view addiction as a demon. I would like to say this to anybody that has any form of addiction, not to judge it, because it was a coping mechanism. It was a friend for many years until it turned dysfunctional. And it does no good to judge it. It will go away in God's time, and it's important to have faith and to be gentle with yourself and to even be respectful towards your addiction, because an addiction like this is not an easy one to go away. As I've said, I've had relapses along the way. But, you know, I got to couples therapy, and I realized I'd have to come back to SAA because that's where I'd received help before. And thank God for it, because I believe it saved my life in many ways after years of suicidal depressions. And I don't know, was depression a part of your past, John?
I definitely think so, yeah. I mean, I don't think I was ever to the point where I was suicidal, but I would agree with you that to try and, you know, be angry at the fact that you have this addiction is not a good way to look at this. You know, in many ways, it was a friend, a companion, as you said, a coping mechanism. It was a comfort. That was when I was lonely. You know, that was what I reached for. That did comfort me. And in many ways, it may have saved my life. But conversely, it certainly could have taken my life. And I know many people
right.
in recovery that has happened. I don't know if that makes, you know, that is a little confusing. But it was such a comfort to me during a period of time when I really needed it. That I had to make peace with it. You know, I had to understand that it was only a part of who I am. The addiction isn't all of me. It's just a small piece of who I am. And it's not, you know, it's not like it can completely, it never completely goes away. But if I can make peace with, if I can make peace with the addiction, then I know that when things, when I have certain thoughts or things that come into my head, I know how to handle it differently than I used to before. And that's one thing I wanted to say is that this addiction, I mean, you know, being a sex addict isn't like a bunch of people in raincoats lurking in the shadows. You know, it's not like that. It's not like, you know, it's no different than if I went to a bar and there's a bunch of guys at a bar and they're talking, you know, and they're objectifying women or men, you know, whatever the case may be. That spurs the addiction. Those are some of the things that get me thinking and can take me into places I don't need to go. And learning to understand that I can't put myself in those environments, I can't allow myself to be triggered by certain experiences. I have to accept that. And then once I do, then I'm able to kind of, you know, handle things much differently, as we've talked about so many times.
Right, right. Well, thank you for that. You know, one thing that I was thinking when you were talking is I like the way you identify yourself during meetings. A lot of people will identify themselves as so-and-so, and I'm a sex addict, and you don't put it that way, and I don't put it that way either. I say I have a sexual addiction, and I'm sexually sober today, and you have another way of putting it that I like very much. I say
I'm in recovery for my sexually addictive behavior and other nonsense.
Right, right. Do you believe sexual addiction is a disease? And if so, can you tell the audience why you believe that to be the case?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a disease. And one example would be like, let's say you were a diabetic. If you didn't eat properly and you didn't take your insulin and you neglected to maintain those things, no question about it, you are going to suffer from your disease. You may lose a limb. You may be hospitalized. You know, it could kill you. You know, that's ultimately what will happen. Sexual addiction is really no different. If I don't go to meetings, if I don't talk to the people in my group, if I don't spend time with God, when you're in the program, we say our higher power. And that's a whole different issue, a whole different topic. But you know, your belief system, if you don't meditate with God, if you don't spend time with God, and for me, part of my recovery is going to church on a regular basis. So if I don't do those things and get to meetings, I can be rest assured that there will eventually, some of the things that I described earlier, things that can just, you know, the disease will, it's very cunning. It creeps up on you when you least expect it. Maybe it's somebody talking to me a certain way or the thought or an image. Being a sex addict is like being addicted to oxygen. I mean, it's all over. It's everywhere. You know, it's not like other addictions. It's very unique in that sense. But I do believe that it is a disease. And if I don't maintain a good, healthy program, very much like the diabetic that takes care of themselves, eats right, exercises, and takes their medication, rest assured, I'm going to relapse and go back into my addiction.
Well, I couldn't have put it better, John, and I really like that analogy. And, you know, the one other thing I would like to add on to what you've said is that we live in a sexually repressive society where sex is judged, and yet it's out there and in your face, and the addiction is rampant, folks. There are estimates that 8% of men and 6% of women are sex addicts, and it could be higher than that. The other thing is the internet has created a whole new arena of sexual acting out. For me, it was like crack cocaine because I would get into these hookup sites, and just going into them and starting to chat with somebody would fire up that dopamine in my brain. And Patrick Carnes, who is the author of several books, including the classic Out of the Shadows, is a PhD who was one of the first people to name sexual addiction a disease. And he has said that the internet will create a tsunami of sexual addiction. So there are people that don't think it's a disease. I'm very much of the opinion of John, and I'm a recovering alcoholic too, and that's acknowledged as a disease. And this is a much more potent addiction. It's been the most difficult addiction for me to deal with because it's not like putting down a substance, and I don't mean to downplay the significance of giving up alcohol if you're an alcoholic. But this has been so much more difficult because sex, I believe, is meant to be a part of a happy and healthy life. It's just that I didn't know how to do that. So, John, you've talked about some of the consequences of the addiction, severe consequences on your family and your professional life. Has your wife been supportive of your recovery?
Extremely. I want to say that during the first year and a half of recovery, it was probably one of the most traumatic times. It was, my wife went through the classic phases of pain, anger, hurt, pulling away. But one of the biggest things that's been difficult to repair is all the years of lies. To rebuild trust again, it's just unbelievable. And even if and as you say, recovery isn't perfect. It isn't. It's part of recovery. And all the times during recovery that I reflect and think back on the biggest challenges that my wife and I have faced are when I've been dishonest. If I'm honest with her, even if I don't tell the truth, and I lie, she always finds out anyway. And then I have to deal with that. It's just so stupid that you'd think that this is something you would learn growing up as a young man, but it's not, unfortunately. It takes years to figure these things out, it seems, at least for me anyway.
Sure.
But yes, she's very supportive, extremely supportive. I attend, somewhere in the neighborhood of around 3 meetings regularly a week, and she's very supportive of that. And, she herself does not attend any meetings or any kind of, like, support group, but, she has gone through therapy as well as I have. So we are working on it, dealing with our program, dealing with my program of recovery, and her and I communicating and keeping the lines of communication open has always it's been very good for us, and that's been a huge success for us. So I'm very happy to say that we're still together, and it's nothing short of a miracle. I mean, by all rights, I mean, when I tell you my wife read through all of my dirty laundry after that bottom that I described to you, she accessed all the websites that I had been active on, and I had been logging in and writing, for lack of better words, like a penthouse letter. My wife read all of that, all of the acting out partners, all the details, all the grisly affairs, all of that vulgar, stuff that was written down. So all of that was disclosed, probably not the best way to find out, and certainly very, very traumatic for her. So for me to sit here and tell you that, that we are still together is nothing short of a miracle.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You've talked about a few things that you've done to manage your addiction, including meetings, speaking with other people in the program. I'm guessing you have a sponsor that you're in touch with, therapy, attending church on a regular basis. Is there anything else that you do as part of your program?
The prayer is a big part of my program, and spending time, in prayer, either in church or at home. And if I feel, the addiction coming on, the prayer really works. And, when you get into program, you learn about steps 2 and 3. 1, 2, and 3, they call the waltz. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. We continue to work those steps over and over and over. And accepting that there is a higher power and believing that has been a huge success to me. And believing that higher power cares for me has been instrumental in my recovery.
I can relate to that. Can you relate the first 3 steps to the audience, or do you want me to do that?
Oh, you can do it. Go ahead.
Okay, the first step is that we admitted we were powerless over addictive sexual behavior and that it had made our lives unmanageable. And the second step is that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And the third step is that we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. Now, 12-step programs are not religious. They're not based on any particular sect or creed. They are spiritual programs, and there are even atheists in these programs, and they are able to define a higher power that works for them, be it something like the group as their higher power. So you do not have to have a faith in God to make recovery work. I just wanted to point that out. So, John, where do you place God in your life today?
It goes God, family, you know, so God is above family, God first, mm-hmm. family second. And when I do that, it always makes my relationships with my family, you know, that much better. When I put God on the back burner, I find out that it gets me in trouble.
How do you define God?
For me, it's the, you know, I guess the Judeo-Christian belief system that, you know, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit. So that would be my higher power.
And what characteristics do you attribute to God?
Oh, loving is the first thing that comes to mind. My belief is that God has this unconditional love for me. And like I was saying to you before, David, it's not like if I do something wacky, or like I said to you, I'm in recovery from my nonsense. If I do something nonsensical, something that pushes me away from the things that are healthy for me, it's not like God stops loving me. He's right there going, hey, get back here, you know? What are you doing? You're out in the, you know, you're out here in the wild. Let's get back to where things are grounded and rooted, and I can guide you. And, you know, my God has this life of abundance that he wants to give me. And if I don't stay close to him and, you know, and take cues when I need to, I can't benefit from that stuff. And the other thing I would say about the God that I believe in, and some people don't really get this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I believe that my God is a jealous God. He doesn't want other things to come before him, and that includes my addiction. It includes my, you know, the drug addiction, the sexual addiction. You know, I can't make bargains with God. I can't be like, oh, yeah, you know, if you let me do this, you know, then I'll do that. No, it doesn't work that way. You know, that's what I mean by he's a jealous God. And that's what I mean by I can't make compromises with God. I have to, it's really black and white. You know, these are the things that you need to do. Once you establish this is how I define my sobriety, these are the things that I'm going to do to stay sober. I can't compromise on those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was something I was going to say, and it just passed right through me. Maybe it will come back, but it seemed like it was something profound connected to something you've said. So in the meantime, I just wanted to ask you, you've talked a little bit about your powerlessness over addictive behavior. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what that's been about for you?
Yeah. When I think of powerlessness, I think of unmanageability. And I'll just tell you just how unmanageable my life used to be. Before my kids were in school, when my business was thriving and it was successful, I was misappropriating money, as I had said to you before. I would go to other cities for the day and spend maybe $1,000 in a day on, you know, three prostitutes in one day. Or I would do an overnight with a prostitute and spend a couple thousand dollars, you know. And all the while, think of the unmanageability. Think of, I'm in another city. What happens if one of my kids were hurt? What if something like that happened? You know, and forget about, you know, safe sex. I mean, when those things were happening, there was no safe sex. You know, it was,
right.
I'll talk about unmanageable. I mean, you know you're not supposed to do that. You know it's dangerous. It can kill you. You can bring a disease home to your partner, which I did, you know, and that's unmanageable. To me, that's powerless. I mean, that's in the throes of the addiction, when things that don't make sense you do anyway. When you know it doesn't make any sense to do this, but I'm still going down that road, it's going to kill me. It's like Russian roulette. You know you shouldn't pull the trigger, but you do it anyway. That's powerlessness.
Thank you. That is powerful. I remembered what I was going to comment on, and that was when you were talking about God. I've heard it said before that if the God you have conceived of does not work for you, reinvent that God. And I had to do that because I used to think of God as judgmental. I thought of the Judeo God, who goes under many different names, who tended to be a more judgmental and could be a vindictive God. And I reframed it in terms of the God that Jesus talked about, which was a God of unconditional love. So that's something that you may want to think about out there. If you've had a problem reconciling God in your life with whatever the issue is that you're dealing with, you can choose your own higher power and choose one that works for you. And you may consider that sacrilegious, but try it. It might work. John, can you tell me what sexual sobriety means to you?
Sure. Because I'm in a committed relationship, it's, you know, to stay sober, I only have sex with my wife. I don't go to strip bars. I don't go to massage parlors. I don't see prostitutes. And I put those behaviors as my bottom line acting out behavior. Pornography and masturbation has always been that sticky widget. You know what I mean? Where does that go? How does that affect you? And in my recovery during these years, I've felt that if I did that, I was acting out. And part of me still feels that way. And I don't say this to make compromise, but in our program of recovery, we have a middle circle, which is where we put things that we shouldn't be doing and we don't go to. But they're also, think of it like we have these three circles of recovery. We have an outer circle, an inner circle, and a middle circle. The outer circle is the healthy behavior for things that we do. And the inner circle is those acting out bottom line behaviors that if I do those things, I'm no longer sexually sober. Then there's a bunch of stuff that goes in the middle circle. So the outer circle is the green light. The middle circle is the flashing red light where I need to say, whoa, stop, hang on, don't do that, you know. And certainly the inner circle is the red light where you have to stop. You know what I mean? That's a no, you know. So masturbation and pornography for me right now are in that middle circle because it helps me to, helps me not to feel the shackles of perfectionism. If I were to see pornography or masturbate with pornography, I certainly don't think that's behavior that I condone. It's not behavior that I think is fair to me, and it's not healthy for my relationship with my wife. But I don't consider myself to have broken my sobriety, if you will.
That's wonderful, John. You're very blessed. What would you say to somebody who's suffering from the addiction and trying to manage it on their own unsuccessfully?
I could never do this on my own. In fact, I thought that I was doomed to a lifetime of these behaviors. There was no way I could even stop. I mean, I knew that come Monday, I was going to be back out doing the same thing over and over and over. And it was compulsion. I had to do it. I had to do it. And I couldn't stop. So I would say to those people that you're not alone. You're not. And into a place where you can talk to some people that can identify with you in some form of recovery is the first thing you need to do. You know, and just walk through the doors. And there's lots and lots of sexual recovery programs in all cities all over. You can go online. I mean, if you can find ways to act out online sexually, you can certainly find recovery programs online as well. And so they can steer
That's
you
right.
in the right direction.
Well, let me spell out a few of them right now, since it seems like an appropriate time. There is a program called SAA that stands for Sex Addicts Anonymous. There is a program called SA that stands for Sexaholics Anonymous. The only caveat I would express with regards to SA is that the only acceptable form of sexual behavior in SA, as I understand it, is sex within a heterosexual marriage. So that program may not work for everybody. Not to say that they don't have a lot of good things to offer. There is SLAA, which is Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and there is SCA, Sexual Compulsives Anonymous. And depending on where you live in the country, you may or may not find some of these programs. If you're unfortunate not to find any of these programs nearby, just go onto these sites because they're online meetings, they're telephone meetings. It's not quite the same as being one-on-one, but you can develop relationships with people over the telephone and work a program that way. So don't lose hope if there's not a program near to you. John, let's back up a little bit and talk about your career life. How did you happen to choose your career?
It sort of chose me. I didn't know what I wanted to do, David. I went to school for architecture and interior design, and when I got out of school, there was no work to be found, and so I ended up taking a job at a home center. And during that period of time, I was very lucky, very fortunate to work in a kitchen and bath department, and I fell in love with the industry. I knew once I started working there and once I started developing relationships with vendors and learning the product, and I began to realize that this whole world of interior design and kitchen and bath was so specialized. It was wonderful because it changed people's lives. I mean, kitchens and bathrooms are where people spend so much of their time, the majority of their time. And to be able to create spaces that could change their lives forever, really, I have been fortunate, very, very fortunate and very blessed to have so many clients that I've been able to change their life.
Well, you sound very passionate about it. I have a twofold question for you. How did you happen to become so successful, and what words of encouragement could you lend to somebody that aspires to a career in design?
My success came from, I honestly believe that I have a gift, a God-given gift. But secondly, as you said it in my mantra, you know, truly, truly exceptional design is always a collaborated effort. So if you want to be successful in anything you do, design anything, you need to be listening to other people, hear what they have to say, take their words of advice and encouragement, and utilize it for yourself. And that's been what's worked for me. And so when I think of design and I think of collaboration, I think of working with a client on a project for their home, and they'll have ideas in their head of what they're looking for. And if I'm not open to listening to what they have to say, I'm going to miss everything. But if I listen carefully, then I can take little nuggets and bits and pieces of what they're talking about and find a way to implement that into a solution that is something that can be very special.
Have there been challenges along the way career-wise? I mean, I know you're in a place of challenge right now.
Yeah, there have been. You know, I've had, when I think about some of the first challenges happened when I began winning design competitions. I began entering some design competitions, and then when I got published in these magazines, one of the first challenges that I encountered was a former employer, wanted to own the proprietary rights to the designs, and I refused to let them go. And so I had a legal entanglement that I ended up walking through and coming out of successfully. And I was able to keep all of my designs, and then I started my own business and began entering more design competitions and became published more frequently. And subsequently, that has that challenge or that adversity that you might say that I was facing turned out really opening the doors for a very fruitful experience and lots of encouraging experiences after that. I've had the opportunity to meet many people on a national level and be involved with the kitchen and bath industry on a national level, which has been very rewarding.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about your career?
I would say that, the biggest thing for me is like I said earlier, the biggest thing for me is it's not – it's the greatest joy that I get is knowing that the projects that I create can be enjoyed for, you know, generations to come. You know, that if even after a client is long gone and they're no longer, you know, on this earth, I've sort of left a legacy behind with the types of work that I do, that lasting memories are created with their family members. So it's very, very rewarding in that respect.
Thank you. John, you've talked about prayer. You've talked about church meetings. Are there any other spiritual practices that you employ to help you manage your life day to day and manage your addiction?
From the place of the Pentecostal faith, we believe in speaking in tongues, which is comes directly out of the second chapter of Acts in the New Testament. So when I'm in a bind or I'm in a tight spot, then I have the gifts of speaking in tongues. So when I'm in a place like that, I will actually begin to worship and praise God and speak in tongues, and I find that addiction can't compete with that.
Well, thank you, John. What would you say to people who have little or no faith?
All it takes is a mustard seed. You know, you don't have to have. I have lots of friends who are self-proclaimed agnostics or atheists, and that's okay. But it's hard for me to look around this earth and not believe that something more powerful than I created it. And the smallest amount of faith, the faith of a mustard seed, is enough to get me through.
I agree wholeheartedly. What would you say your primary purpose is for today?
Today is my primary purpose. I think I'm here. I think God has a bigger plan for me, that I'm here. I don't even know what that is yet. So my purpose is to figure out what that plan that God has in store for me, and that might mean helping other people, and I'm not sure exactly where that's going. But that's my purpose right now, is to just to be obedient, keep myself going in my recovery, and be dedicated to my family, and then God's going to take care of the rest.
That sounds like faith to me, John.
Thanks, David.
Well, thank you for being with me tonight. It's really been a pleasure. I'm going to put in a plug for another book of mine because it has to deal with sexual addiction. It's called, oh my God, it's called Shades of Gay by David Clark with an E, and it seems like an appropriate time to bring it up because it is a story similar to my own. It's about a gay man who has led a life colored by alcohol and sexual addiction, and he comes to a crisis when he's confronted by his partner, and he has to choose between the cheap and shallow thrills of the moment and going for something that's more lasting and spiritually uplifting. And it's a book that's down and dirty. It shows the addiction for what it is, and it's going to turn some people off, quite frankly. But I did it this way on purpose. But it does lead to higher ground, and it has a message of hope. It's a story of triumph and redemption, and it even has humor in it. So that's Shades of Gay by David Clark on Amazon.com. And that wraps it up for today, folks. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you again, John. It really has been a pleasure to have you. I appreciate your courage in stepping forward and your honesty, which is one of the cornerstones of the 12-step program. There's an acronym called HOW, which stands for honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And if you have those three qualities and a desire to get sober, so once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There's no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.